Scripture reading today comes from Luke 8, 1 through 3. After this, Jesus traveled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out, Joanna, the wife of Cusa, and the manager of Herod's households, Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. This is the word of the Lord.
I have a serious subject to talk to you about this morning. It's going to require some thought, require you to think, but you should all be able to do that. You've all had an extra hour of sleep, right? So there's no excuse today for any nodding off during the sermon, okay? No yawns. Although I don't think this subject is going to elicit any yawns. I'm going to start with 3 points of commentary from the news. I'm going to start with 3 sociological points. The first is Gail Collins, who has written a new book on the history of feminism, or maybe I should say history of the women's movement. A lot of to many people, that word feminism is kind of still a toxic word. Many women don't want to be called feminist. So let's just say the women's movement. The history of the women's movement over the last 3 or 4 decades, from the 1970s. And she talks about the great improvements that have happened for women in the workplace, in the marketplace. Equal pay, or at least approaching equal pay for equal work. Expanded opportunities of women in jobs, all very good stuff. What's very interesting about the book, though, also is the way that Collins talks about what hasn't changed in the last few decades. And Amy Bloom, who reviewed her book in the New York Times, talks about how really Collins seems makes the strongest case about what she's saying when she talks about what hasn't changed. And what hasn't changed, she says, is dynamics in relationships between men and women. That's something that the women's movement seems to not have changed too much. And what the way Amy Bloom puts it is, feminism did not remake the world of relationships. Something there that suggests to us, if this is so, that maybe there's something real about gender that comes out in relationships. Between men and women. That expresses itself in relationships. Okay, that's point number one. Second item. The news from the Wharton School professors, Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, came out earlier this year. Their study found that despite all the improvements of their lives over the past 4 decades, women today appear to be less happy than they were in 1972. An interesting result. You know, and with some of these happiness studies, you want to be a little bit skeptical. I mean, how do you really measure that? Of course, it's measured by surveys, people self-reporting whether or not they're happy, how happy they are. And these researchers found a statistically significant, trend in the replies. It at least suggests that if there really is declining female happiness since the 1970s, it at least suggests that the happiness of women might not be related or might be related to events other than those in the marketplace, in the workplace, in which great gains have been made for women. Suggests. Third, Joanne Lipman, who some of you might know as former deputy managing editor at the Wall Street Journal, Joanne Lipman came out and was talking about the kind of issues of changes in the workplace. And she observed something very interesting with all these people losing their jobs, both men and women. She's pointing out that in 40% of the households now, women are the primary breadwinners. And this is what Lipman says. She says, "I'm in the unfortunate position of witnessing many friends and colleagues laid off over the past year. But the women are less apt to fall apart. And this goes even for the primary breadwinners, because they're less likely to define themselves by their job in the first place." Unquote. Another interesting point, she's saying that people are losing their jobs, women and men, but she notices that the women seem to not fall apart as much as men when they lose their jobs, perhaps pointing us to the notion that, you know, there is a real difference in gender. There's a gender difference going on. And perhaps the workplace is not going to be a place where you recognize what makes a woman a woman. So all these things pointing, friends, I think, indications to us to take a look at a subject that we're not really supposed to talk about, and that is gender. A subject that is not really addressed. But we need to address it this morning because it's in our passage. And it's not only in our passage that you just heard read. It's actually throughout this gospel, throughout the Gospel of Luke, there's this issue that comes up because there's such an emphasis in Luke on women. Now, this gospel that we've been reading through, those of you who've been with us here, know that we're reading through the Gospel of Luke, which is all about the welcoming of outsiders into Christ's salvation. The welcoming of those outside in various ways into the kingdom of heaven, into the feast of the kingdom of heaven that Jesus provides. So it's interesting, probably not unrelated, that Luke spends so much time in his gospel talking about women. You can go through, see even, you know, the reference to Peter's mother-in-law in chapter 4. In chapter 8, this same chapter later on, we have a woman with a hemorrhage of blood whom Jesus heals. Chapter 20, Jesus gets upset about how the Pharisees are treating widows. Chapter 21, Jesus is praising a widow for her gift of a mite to the temple. Chapter 23, we meet women at the crucifixion. Chapter 24, we meet women at the tomb. Well, these are points of, the Gospel of Luke where you can see women coming to the fore. But you can also read about these in other Gospels as well. And some of these show up in Matthew or John or Mark. What's perhaps even more interesting are the many passages in the Gospel of Luke that are uniquely Lucan, we could say, that are about women, that bring women forward. Okay? From the very beginning, chapter 1, many details in chapter 1 about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and her story of what's going on there. Also in chapter 1, a whole account about Elizabeth, who was the mother of John the Baptist. So it's very interesting that from the very beginning of the gospel, you have sort of the experience of women in this whole story. Then you get to chapter 2, there's Anna, the prophetess. You know, unique in Luke's gospel, we find there's a woman very much, very early in Jesus' life, who's playing a role in what's going on. Chapter 7, the widow of Nain, for whom Jesus raises a son from the dead. This widow comes along, and for this woman, Jesus does this amazing miracle, raises a son from the dead. Also in chapter 7, there's a sinful woman who, out of gratitude for what Jesus has done for her in forgiving her, anoints the feet of Jesus. Chapter 10, there are certain events that are unique events about Martha and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus. Chapter 13, a woman crippled for 18 years, Jesus heals. Chapter 23, Jesus is carrying his cross to Golgotha, and in the midst of his great pain, he's under intense pain and an intense trial. He turns around to shroud the women of Jerusalem with compassion. Turns around to speak to the daughters of Jerusalem in the Gospel of Luke. Even in the midst of his trial, he turns around to comfort these women who were coming along beside and behind him, mourning what was going on. That's pointed out in Luke. And even in this passage, we have a unique look into the community of Jesus, how there were these women who were part of this traveling entourage that was going on. So you see all these added dimensions, added emphases to women in the story of Jesus, in the life of Jesus, in the ministry of Jesus. But, you know, it's not just in his ministry, it's also in his teaching. It's only in this gospel we read in chapter 15 of the parable of the woman with the lost coin. And then in chapter 18, again, only in this gospel, the parable of the widow and the judge. So you see, this gospel is showing us how very integral women are to, but not only to the life of Jesus, but to the very thought of Jesus. It's very cool. You know, and I would just point this out. I won't go through them all. But just remember that this is only part one, this book, of a two-volume work called Luke and Acts. And in part two, you go and read that book, you'll find 13 different passages that focus on particular women. What is this saying to us, friends? This biblical author loves women. Obviously, it wants to make the point of how important they are to the coming of the kingdom of heaven. Obviously. And you know, this is not just Luke. Actually, this is a continuing of a long biblical tradition that brings women in and shows their importance to what God is doing in the earth. All the way back, you go back to the beginning, go back to Genesis, you know, the very beginning, it was big news. Moses came out with this statement. You know, women too are made in the image of God. That was big news at the time. Friends, this is the beginning of a long history of biblical writers contradicting the culture in their views about women. That was not the view of women in the ancient world. So it was a big contradiction for Moses to come out and that and say, yes, men and women, both created in the image of God. So this is something that's very different. If you really take a look at it, friends, the biblical religion, as opposed to other, especially other world major religions, this is not the view that you get. You know, the view of the other religions, you look in their ancient books, you don't see this emphasis on women. It's closer to kind of the view of the ancient Greeks, you know, Aristotle, who basically was pretty explicit that a woman is an inferior man. It's sort of like a birth defect. Okay, there's something that goes wrong at birth, and you know, you don't get a man, you get a woman. That's what Aristotle says. So it's a very different kind of picture that we're getting here. So it's very difficult, first of all, friends, to get a religion out of the Bible that de-emphasizes women or somehow demeans their importance in what God's doing in the world. So what we find in this passage, we can go even further. You notice that Luke says there were these women that were ministering, serving out of their means in the community. And he names a few of them. He names this woman, Susanna. You see that there? Susanna. Of which little is known. In fact, nothing is known because this is the only place where this name appears in the New Testament. It's the only place where she is mentioned in the New Testament. Now let's think about that for a minute. Here we have this woman, Susanna. There's no story to her. There's no real anything to prove. There's no kind of point to be made. And yet Luke mentions her and specifically names her. How come? Why is it that Luke would include this name in his account? Now, you can think of different reasons, but really the only good reason, and I invite you to think of different reasons why this name would be here, but the only really good reason, I would say, is because she must have later been famous in some way. She must have later somehow been known. Somebody who later became important. She was someone then you could talk to, a witness. Now, we don't know her. We don't know Susanna, but apparently the readers of this text could, you know. Like, you know that old woman. She has some money, lives in Antioch. She traveled with him. She was one of those who was with him. We could talk to her. We could go and talk to her, see if these things were the way they happened. This passage right here seems kind of, you might just glance over it, beginning of chapter 8. But it actually forms something of a structure in the book. Because there's another passage toward the end of the gospel. This is sort of near the beginning, not the very beginning, but, you know, in the Jesus' Galilean ministry. He brings up these women, say, there's these women traveling with Jesus, and here's some of their names. Mary of Magdalena, there's Susanna, there's Joanna. And then you get to the near the end of the Gospel of Luke, end of chapter 23, chapter 24. What happens? We see these women come up again. Chapter 23, verse 55, Luke says, the women who had come with Jesus from Galilee, okay, followed Joseph, this is Joseph of Arimathea, and saw the tomb and after the crucifixion where Jesus' body was laid. And then they go on with the story. They say, you know, it comes to Sunday morning, and these women go to the tomb. Jesus isn't there. If they find it empty, and these angels appear, and they speak to them. And then chapter 24, verse 10, Luke says, tells us who the women were to whom the angels spoke. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, mother of James, and the others. And these were the women who told the apostles. Says Luke in chapter 24. And so what this is doing, friends, is forming what we could call an inclusio. An inclusio is something that has two bookends that includes material in between. It forms a kind of structure to the book. In other words, these women are there from here to there. That's what he's saying. They're witnesses of the things in between. Forms an inclusio. That's what the author is doing. But, you know, it says more than just that these women were among the eyewitnesses of this gospel. It says more. You know, earlier on I had quoted in this series, I quoted the scholar Richard Baucom, who's done some very interesting work with ancient authors and how they substantiated their historical accounts. When authors were trying to write something and tell you it happened and substantiate that account, they would bring in their sources into their story and show how they were there at the beginning, and so the beginning of the work they show up, and then at the end of the work they show up. They form this inclusio. And ancient authors, Baucom argues, are doing this, and he gives you a number of examples, to show, these are my sources. This is how you can. This is how I substantiate my text. This is how I can tell you and assure you that this happened, because this person who's my source was here at the beginning, and then this person comes in at the end. And what we find when Baucom comes to the Gospel of Luke is that Luke does this with the apostles. At the very beginning, the apostles show up and are named in the story, and then they're there at the very end. Thereby, Luke is saying, look, here are the sources for my account. But what's interesting, friends, is that nested inside that inclusio are these women showing up in the ministry of Galilee, saying, here they are, and then at the end, at the empty tomb, there they are again. So he's nesting inside this apostolic inclusio, this inclusio of these women, Mary Magdalene and Joanna, which means it's probably these women to whom Luke owed much of his eyewitness testimony. Do you know what this means? Do you see what this means? This is why we probably have these unique passages in the Gospel of Luke, of Jesus teaching about and involving and using and acting toward these women. Because that is what Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Susanna are going to remember. They're going to remember the widow of Nain. They're going to remember the widow's mite when Jesus said that. In other words, friends, Luke, to a large extent, relates a woman's perspective on Jesus. So how cool is that? That's what we're getting, apparently, in the Gospel of Luke. So what do we learn from this? What should we take from this as people who are trying to take the Scriptures into our lives and enact them? We should take, first of all, friends, that a woman's voice is crucial to the work of Jesus Christ, is crucial to hear. That the very book itself is a testimony to the importance of a woman's perspective in the ongoing ministry of Jesus Christ in the world. This very passage and the way it's structured should call us to see the ongoing importance then of women in the church. So, you know, women's voices are crucial, are critical to the operation. Critical to hear. And, you know, this is a lesson that when I became a pastor here, I really wanted to see happen. I wanted to enact this because of this passage and others that bring out the importance of making sure that women are involved and their voices are heard. So, you know, people can espouse different views of, you know, this is, you know, theoretically, this is what I think about men and women in various things, in various roles. If you really want to get the lowdown, though, on an organization, you really want to get what's going on, look at the practice of the organization. And I am proud, very proud, to invite you to look at the practices here at the Village Church. Because this is something that has been very important to me. And I can give you some of the structures that we have set up here specifically to bring in the voice of women, make sure their perspective is going to be heard. I can give you a few of them here. We have this thing called the Council of Dangerous Subversives. It meets once a month. In fact, we're meeting tomorrow night. And people who are involved in leading ministries or leading fellowship groups are invited to attend. And one of the main reasons for having that group, we meet every month, is to make sure women are involved. I mean, it's a time for me to teach and to try to equip the leaders, but also I see it as very much a time where I'm listening to what's going on, what are the important issues in the issues of the church. And so women are specifically brought in there so that every month there's a place where I can be sure to be listening to the voice of women in the congregation. I'll give you another example. Before I preach a sermon, I deliver it to a woman every sermon. For the past 7 years, every sermon that you get has been filtered through a woman. I give it to my wife first, and I get criticism from it. So that everyone, so that on Sundays, you know, what you're getting has been filtered through a woman. It's another way. We have this group called Zora Horses. It's a long story. But, you know, we don't meet as often as we used to, but this was a group to bring in the kind of wives of elders, wives of interns, to help them help the interns of the church and also discuss issues of leadership. This was something that we, you know, if you were an intern at this church, you'd know this was something you had to go through in creating a message for the church. That's another one. That's why we've designed certain aspects of our mercy network in the way that we have, is specifically to bring women to the fore in that. And, you know, well, gosh, this elders retreat, we're going on an elders retreat this month. And it's very important. It's not just the elders. It's the elders and their wives, specifically so we can have the woman's voice. So all these different ways in the Village Church are trying to enact this passage to a woman's perspective, woman's concerns, woman's voice is central to what a church is, the way it operates. So that's the first point here. That Jesus welcomes women into not only to be ministered to, but to minister into the operation of his kingdom. The second point, though, that we can see in this passage also, is that there is a distinguishing between women and men. There's a call here to distinguish, as verse 1 distinguishes from verse 2, the women and the men. So there were apostles who were men, and here we mentioned the 12 who were all men, and then there were women. And this distinction is carried through in the rest of the New Testament, even when the term apostle is broadened to include other people beyond the 12. They're always men. There's one place where it's a debatable example where there's a name mentioned. It could be either a woman or a man, but it could be used either way. It's not something we can, I feel, really put our weight on. And so what we see is a kind of a continuation of this distinction. Now, this part is hard to speak of because, you know, immediately there's such a disapproval in the culture about this issue. But hey, this is the Village Church. Okay, what are we here for? We're here to be nonconformists, right? This is our raison d'être. We're here to be to not conform to the culture. And so that's what we're willing to do, is take a look at these things and see if there are places where the Bible challenges the current cultural thinking, then we should speak. And in this case, I think there is, especially the academic thinking, the general academic thinking today, the idea is that someone's sex is separate from their gender, and that gender itself is a social construct. Right, that's what we get. It's not really real. It's something society puts on us. And so it's malleable and changeable. And I would argue with you, friends, that the Bible teaches rather that one's sex is part and parcel of a larger reality of a person, that is his or her gender. And, you know, Christianity does not allow you to demean the body. People would like to say, well, it's just genitalia. It doesn't matter. It's just part of the body. The Bible never allows you to demean the body in that way. The body is a very important part of who you are. And of course, when you get into it, it's a lot more, far, far more differences between men and women than simply genitalia. Far more differences, even just physically. So the Bible, I would argue, the Bible teaches that sex is part of this larger reality of a person called their gender. And that reality is not a social construct. Although it comes draped in social constructs. There's always the reality of gender, but in different cultures it comes through differently. It wears different clothes. So there is gender, but it's draped differently in different cultures. And I think it's important to make that point. I try to in different ways when I speak about this, because I think the fear is, when you bring this subject up, the fear is, people are afraid that they're going to be asked to submit to the stereotypes, you know, of cultural drapery, I can put it that way, that you're going to be made to, you know, kind of be Ozzie and Harriet or something like that. You know, a different culture, and you're going to be asked to submit to that. But, you know, as I said, we don't want to support stereotypes here. We're the Village Church. Okay, we're not about that at all. We're not interested in proclaiming and propagating some kind of patriarchal stereotypes. We're not into that. And I could give you several examples. I'll give you an example of myself. Okay, take me, for example. I'm a man. Okay, and I'm a real man. Just want you to know that. And I have never in my life drank a can of beer. Never. Not one. You want to make something of that? Anybody want to make something about that? I'll step outside with you. Okay? This is not what we're talking about, friends. And what I want to try to do for a few minutes here is try to explain to you what the purpose of this is, what the purpose of gender distinctions and responsibilities are. Hopefully help you able to be more comfortable in seeing why God would do it this way. Well, the first thing to realize, if gender matters, is that gender responsibilities really only come into play at a certain depth of relationship, because it's really about relationship. That gender responsibilities, they're relationships. Well, I guess that's the first thing to realize, friends, is to realize there are different levels of relationship in your life, and that's appropriate. You got to be aware of the appropriate levels of relationship in your life. Now, those levels are, you know, not as deep in a working relationship, you know, but more deep in other areas of your life. Now, this has been something that's been a long road for me to realize. I never realized this. Earlier, I used to work for Chase Manhattan Bank. And when I worked there, I didn't understand the appropriate distance of working relationships. So I was often trying to bring my wife into functions where spouses were not really welcome. You know, there would be some bank function that would go on. I would come to my boss and I'd say, "Oh, great. Well, can my wife come?" And there would be this puzzled expression on his face. So, "Why are you asking this? You know, this is as if this were a new question." But what I realized later on is that I was not being sensitive to the appropriate level of work relationships. Okay, I wanted Chase to be one big family. I wanted my wife to know my coworkers. I wanted they to know her. I wanted us to all be friends. I wanted Chase to be a church. But, you know, Chase is not a church. It's a bank. So I was often disappointed in my efforts this year. And this is just to help us realize there are different levels of relationship in your life that are appropriate. And that's why this gender distinction, gender responsibilities don't really come into practice and don't really come into play in areas of politics or the workplace. Because relationships at work have an appropriate distance and they don't generally reach the level at which gender distinctions come into play. Okay, only at a certain level of relationship do gender responsibilities come into play, I would say, such as in a church or in a family. Well, you know, here we are in a church, friends, and so we distinguish gender. Okay, so how do we distinguish gender when it comes into play here? Well, in this church, what you find is the ultimate responsibility for deciding matters of the whole church is laid upon men. The ultimate responsibility for the formation of the church through its teaching is laid on one man. And their ultimate responsibility to glue the church together is laid on women. There are different responsibilities laid there to make the community what it is, to make the community a community. And, you know, you could see this, how this would matter in different companies. Different companies, you know, you could see how it could be all women or it could be no women. It wouldn't make any difference whether it was all women or all men. But I can't imagine, I can't even imagine how a church could function without women. I can't imagine that. Now, here's what I want to propose to you. If this is a biblical teaching, and if this teaching is right, and I believe it is, then we would expect to find, friends, that there's a real need that's being met in people acting in these responsibilities. That this is going to meet a real need in us, you would expect, right? If it's right. Do we find that to be true? And what I'd like to argue with you is that we do. I certainly see it here. Because the point of gender responsibilities turns out to be for the other gender. There's a yin-yang to this thing. There's a completion dynamic happening in these. What we find that when a man acts as a man, the reason he does so is for the sake of a woman's progress, for the sake of a woman's development, of her blossoming, to see her flourish as a woman. And likewise, a woman acts to help a man progress in his manhood. That's what gender is for. So gender really calls us to be who we are for the sake of the other. That's why, you know, when you have a battle of sexes going on in the parties concerned, this doesn't really work. You can see how if the point of these things is for the other gender, then if you have a battle of sexes going on, then this stuff doesn't really work. It can only work in the context of love. They depend upon a motivation to see the other party develop, if I can put it that way. So let me give you a few analogies, say three analogies from Christian marriage to maybe help try to explain this to you. Okay, first, as far as a husband and a marriage goes, because I think there is analogies here. Okay, in a Christian marriage, a husband is supposed to act as a head in a way. But it's for a specific purpose. And you know what that purpose is? It's to make the wife glorious. The Apostle Paul says, 1 Corinthians 11, that the wife is, in fact, the glory of the relationship. That's the way the husband is supposed to look at her. She's the glory of the thing, of the whole operation. And Peter says, 1 Peter 3, that the point of man being given this position is to develop their wives. The point of being in a stronger position is to lift her up as an heir of life. Okay, so that's what the point of the husband's role in a marriage is supposed to be doing. It's to be ensuring that the woman is the glory of the whole thing. And so by analogy, friends, we look at a church, the women should be understood as the glory of the church. And in fact, they are. You know, when women are in a church are doing well, things are good. Things are meant to be as they should when the women are doing well in a church. So similarly, the second analogy, look at it from the wife's perspective. Okay, a surrender of prerogative in a Christian marriage for a wife is a tool. It's a tool of a wife to assist the husband that she loves to take steps in his manhood. You know, young wives often find that their greatest frustration, and this is not what they expected, often find that their great frustration in a marriage is their man is not engaging or taking initiatives in areas where he should, in areas where he could. So they're looking at their husband and saying, we really should be taking more initiative here, more in areas where he could, in areas where he should. Well, how do you think that change is going to happen? There's a tool given to a wife to do that. And so by analogy, friends, in a church, women's willingness in a church to entrust the leading of the church to male elders by their election of them is to assist the men of the church in personally moving forward. That's the point. So if you understand it this way, you see, this is really a beautiful mosaic of mutual dependence that's created here. And it develops a depth of relationship like nothing else does. You know why? Because you both matter so much to what's going on. You're not interchangeable. You matter to the other. It's, you know, and I grieve because, unfortunately, this mosaic is so obscured by the cultural battles that it's rarely or clearly seen today. And so we lose womanhood, lose manhood. You know, the third analogy I would bring is how this looks from the outside. Okay, very often, when single people look at this thing in marriage, in Christian marriage, and you talk about this, what the husband does, what the wife does, very often single people look at this and say, what on earth are you talking about? I mean, how on earth, why would we do such a thing? Why would I engage in such? It doesn't make any sense at all. It's very hard to see from the outside. The only time it starts to make sense is when you're in the context of somebody that you want to see develop. You want to see progress. That's when it starts to make sense. Very difficult to look at this from the outside of a marriage. And similarly, okay, here's the analogy. It's the same way with the church. You know, churches have these conventions and, you know, assemblies, and they try to pass resolutions about what women should be doing, what men should be doing. And the outside world is just looking at them and laughing. And this is a joke. They say, how could you possibly be discussing this in this day and age, whether or not women can serve as priests and so forth? It just looks ridiculous from the outside. You have to be in the context of a church with deep relationships for this to make sense. Actually, a real church. You have to be in a live, real live church for this to make sense. And I hope it can for you, because as Henry Miller put it in our meditation, you lose polarity of the sexes, you see the disappearance of great men. And I would say, I would add also great women. So that's the distinction part. Thirdly, though, finally, and really this is the most important part of the passage, Jesus not only welcomes women, not only distinguishes women, he's also the savior of women. And if you look at this passage, you find that the women were there. The reason why the women were there trying to serve and do and support of their own means is because of what Jesus did for them. And here there isn't a distinction. It's just like the apostles. Like Peter, into whose boat Jesus stepped, you remember that, when we saw how it was that Jesus engendered such loyalty in his apostles. Just like Peter. You could see here that Mary Magdalene was with Jesus because of what Jesus had done for her. Seven demons. That it's said that that's a way of saying that this person was in a place of the greatest personal oppression that you can be in. And this is what Jesus brought her out of. Something that was insoluble. He brought her out. Brought her into freedom. That's why she was there. In the chapter just previous, I made mention of this woman who came in with her tears. And out of the gratitude for her forgiveness, I don't think it was Mary Magdalene. I don't think it was her. It was someone else. Washed his feet with her tears and her hair. So what we see is here is a place there's no difference between the men and the women in this company. They were both there because of what Jesus had done for them. And what this tells us, friends, is that not only do women need Jesus as much as men, but that he's available to them, you know, to meet those needs. There is such an emphasis today on the formation of independence in women that sometimes this gets lost. And when this message gets lost, man or woman, you lose the power of the gospel. You know, if you go to the end of this, the other end of this inclusio, and you read about the women at the tomb, the angel shows up, and you know what he says to them? He says to the women, "He is not here, but he has risen. Remember how he told you, while he was still in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." How he told you is a very significant phrase, because it's very clear from the Gospels that Jesus wasn't telling everybody about what was going to happen. It's very clear that he took his innermost circle to explain to them that this is what was going to happen to him. He was going to die and rise again, and this was something his leaders had to know. And so when the angel says that to them, it must mean that the women were included in that private conference. In all those times when Jesus took the apostles aside and said, "Listen, I'm going to die and rise again. You have to know this. You especially have to know this." That means the women were there. They had to know it too. He had to die and rise again for them. And so the most important message of this passage is that Jesus' salvation extends to women. His answer to them is himself. They need to know they're co-sinners. They need to know they're co-forgiven as well. But Jesus doesn't just relate well to men. You know those guys, you know, who hang around, and they're great at hanging around with guys, but they don't seem to get it. They can't seem to hang around with women. Okay, it makes them uncomfortable or something. They either cannot or don't want to. They just don't want to deal with it. So it doesn't work around women. Jesus is not one of those guys. He's not just relating to men. He offers an equal opportunity salvation. We both need it. Okay, finally, folks, I want to finish by just noting how unusual this community was. If you look at verse 3, it says that these women were kind of supporting this operation of their own means. And, you know, that... to have a religious leader supported by women of means was not unusual in the first century. It wasn't unusual even for an itinerant ministry, itinerant rabbi, to be supported by women of means. You know what was uncommon, though? Was very unusual, is to have a woman traveling with him. That was not done. For instance, we're talking about the Middle East here. So, if you look at verse 3, and many others, you see, women were a big part of what was going on there in significant numbers. Well, this was scandalous. And all, just like the apostles, the women were diverse. One was married here. Joanna was of high standing. So what Jesus was doing here was creating this traveling community. He's basically creating a traveling church. And he elevated the women here by doing this to a position of respect, not by surrendering the call of the men to lead the community, but by focusing men on their attention on the goal of that leadership, just what he was doing, that is bringing women into glory. And the most striking thing about this passage is that Jesus did it this way, that he set it up this way. Because from the get-go, friends, it means that his ministry would be suspect. This arrangement would have been considered shameful. At the very least, people would have been suspicious about what was going on with these traveling women, especially considering the past of some of these women. But Jesus did it anyway. Evidently, Jesus thought there was something more important here about their presence among them, that he would be comfortable scandalizing the current society. What was so important? What was so crucial to have to take this kind of risk for him? It was women being able to express their gratitude to him in their service, out of whatever means they had. Now, obviously, they're talking about money here. You may say, oh, I don't have means to support. Well, whatever means you have, what you're called to in the community of Jesus is to bring forth the means that you do have. Your call is to nourish this community, to make this community a community, what it is, with whatever it is that you have. So, friends, as we come now to the table, I want you to invite you to consider these things. I want to ask you if we can make a Village Church a place where we're not just tolerating the other gender, we're celebrating the other gender to develop one another in love. Amen. Amen. Will you stand, please?